Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. This episode features Nick Grantham, leading sports and conditioning coach who has worked with everyone from Premiership football teams to Olympic athletes to the Royal Ballet. We delve into the intricacies behind high performance at the most elite levels, drawing on Nick's work with world-class athletes in over 35 different sports. Well, welcome, Nick. We are really pleased that you've joined us. So you've had a career for over 20 years in performance sport. Can you share with us some of your biggest highlights?
Gosh, yeah, stretching back over 20 plus years. I think seeing the very first Olympian that I worked with, that was pretty special. And getting a phone call at about 2 o'clock in the morning because they were competing at the Olympics in Sydney to say, Nick, I've made the final, which at the time was huge. So that was probably wasn't a highlight for my wife, given woken up at 2:30 in the morning to get that news. She probably thought it could have waited. But that was a special moment, and seeing them compete and realise their potential. And then competing and helping people compete at London 2012, but the ability to share that with my family was massive, that they could come to London and they could see the work that I was doing and meet the athletes that you're working with and be part of that journey. So that's a real highlight. And then I think on a slightly different scale is just regularly getting updates from either athletes or coaches or other sports scientists that I've helped in like really small ways, just as part of their career progressions. I sometimes get an email just saying, oh, I've just landed this role, I'm now moving to this area. So that's a big sense of satisfaction as well. It's not just about standing on top of podiums, winning medals around your neck. It's the smaller bits as well.
I think the way you've just described that tells us everything about your motivation, because it's so interesting. I know we're going to get into motivations, both yours and potentially the people that you work with, but that affiliation piece for you and almost that impact on people. So it's not actually just about this end achievement or end goal, but actually the feeling of motivation, satisfaction from helping people on their journeys achieve the things that are important to them kind of comes through loud and clear on that.
Yeah, I think one of the big things is like a legacy piece. It's trying to leave whichever environment or person that I work with, that hopefully when I finish working with them, they're in a better position than they were before. It still may not be achieving their ultimate goal, but we're moving in that right direction. So that's massive.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because when we were looking at your profile, we thought you might be more achievement driven, right? But actually that affiliation is, it's the people bit. And honestly, if we could have written a description for affiliation, that would have been what you just said there when you were describing like your highlights, which is such a lovely piece. And it doesn't mean you're not driven by achieving. It just means the people bit is your achievement measure. And you just described that really well.
Like everyone's got an ego. Like I've got an ego as well. But we're called backroom staff for a reason. Like we should be in the shadows. And we should, of course, you get the reflected glory. I mean, my kids get bored every time an Olympic comes on. I say, oh, I worked with her when she was like 17, 18. We know, Dad. But that's the piece, is knowing you've had an impact, not necessarily standing next to them, having your selfie taken for Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. What led you to decide to become like a sports coach? Tell us a bit about that journey.
It was probably a fairly convoluted journey. Like no one in my family had been to university. We all kind of left and got safe jobs. I started working in a bank, which for someone who got a D in maths is probably not the best environment to go into. I was horrific. And then I went to insurance, and I worked in an insurance company for 4 years, and I was just really bad at it. And then at the time, I was training and competing in taekwondo, and one of my teammates was studying sports science, and I didn't even know that was a career pathway. I just thought people went to university to study like really clever stuff, and it was a guy learning about sport and how to train, and I was already becoming increasingly interested in how I trained and how I could make myself better, and it was the first time I was buying books for my own sort of knowledge, and then I discovered you could go to university for it. So I thought, right, this sounds interesting. I originally thought I was going to go and do sports psychology, and then within about 6 weeks of the first semester, I was realised that it's not that it's common sense, but actually the physiology side of things was really interesting, as well as the psychological piece. So that's what kind of drove me to it, was my own interest in how I can perform myself to improve my sporting career, but then knowing that you're not going to be an athlete forever, so the next best thing is working with athletes for as long as you can and impacting on performance. So that's kind of what led me there.
And you've bucked the trend a little bit of not specialising in one sport. I think you specialise, you've gone across 35 different sports, yeah, from ballet to football. And yeah, talk a little bit about what the driver behind that was.
I think particularly within the industry, there is a little bit of snobbery around being, I say I'm a specialist generalist. So I'm actually a specialist in being able to onboard into different sports and different environments very quickly and upskill and have an impact. I first started off with gymnastics. That's my first sport. And it still will be probably my number one sport that I've really enjoyed working with because it had such a big impact. But there's only so many countries that you can work in with that sport to a high level. And GB was of a really good standard. I then went to England netball. And again, similar thing in terms of internationally, there's only three or four countries that are really, really good. England was one of those. So unless I wanted to go to Australia or New Zealand and relocate, the path was somewhat limited. At the time, the English Institute of Sport was just about coming online after the lottery funding. And that was my first exposure to sort of a multi-sport environment. And very quickly you realise when you're exposed to a region with, say, 25 different sports and you're in a gym and there are wheelchair basketball players, track and field athletes, female rugby players, all training together, whilst they're all very different sports and very different types of athletes, there are commonalities. And I think it's then that I saw the breadth, and that variety piece was really stimulating and interesting for me. I didn't want to learn more and more about less and less, which is what happens when you become a specialist and you hit a niche. And there are some niches that are probably big enough to have a long career, but sport is very volatile. So I kind of just felt having a breadth of knowledge would support a career, a long-term career, and stop me from getting stale.
It's quite a strategic move, really. And it, just listening to when you said a safe job when you first left school,
yeah,
it almost like reduces some of the risk and that volatility across that particular sporting industry.
Yeah.
But also you've got a massive appetite for change and looking at variety, I suppose, in the sense of if you've got more variety in the sport, it keeps you interested, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I would see a lot of colleagues when I was working who were specialising in one sport and maybe even working for a government institute, they're thinking, all right, I'm fine here. I've got a four-year cycle. But if you don't hit the medal target, you don't get the funding. And then your funding for a full-time role goes down to a half position. And all of a sudden, you're scrapping around trying to find another role to make up that sort of loss of earnings. Whereas by diversifying and having multiple income streams from different sports, it allowed, if something dropped out, so if some consultancy with the team dropped out, then I might have some of my speaking work that I could go and do, or I could deliver some webinars. When you work for yourself, you have to have that diversity of
that
approach.
That portfolio, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm interested in what you have seen as some of the commonalities between athletes, because you know, we do performance in the workplace, yeah, right? So we've got lots of common threads, albeit different end users, I suppose. Mm. And we get asked that question all the time around, you know, well, a high-performance engineer has to be different to a high-performance salesperson. And our answers are kind of similar to yours. Well, the technicality of what they do is different, yes. But there are common core performance drivers. You know, for us, motivation being one of them. If you're motivated by what you do, you'll be way more likely to perform, and that spans sectors. What have you seen with the athletes that you work with that are some of the commonalities that you've seen cross sport?
Like any high performance practitioner or athlete, they are brilliant at the basics. So they nail the fundamentals first and foremost. And that's, you have your cornerstones of performance that they do over and over again, and they have a high level of commitment. Again, that's about doing the boring stuff over and over again really, really well. So a lot of people get into this kind of Motivation Monday type thing. Let's have a motivational quote and that'll get us going. Athletes don't need that. They're very good at riding that motivational roller coaster when it's high and low of just being able to commit. And when you're at the bottom, you still know you've got to go out and do your session. You still know you've got to go out and train. So you'll do that. And even when the motivation's really high, you still go out there. And I think anyone that performs to a higher standard is really good at just that consistency. Consistency pays the bills. It's not very sexy. It's not very flashy. But that's what gets the job done. And you see athletes that have got a level of talent, whatever that talent is. That's probably like a genetic predisposition and probably to a certain extent the nurture where you were born and how you were raised. But that will only ever get you so far. Within sport, there's levels. So that will get you to a certain level. But then the people that really transcend and go to the top, that are stood on top of podiums, that have medals around their neck, that's about that consistency of approach and delivering when it's not the day that you really want to be out there doing it.
Yeah.
What's your belief on, we've had people on the podcast who are athletes, and there's been a common theme of, you know, where does talent come in? You know, you've mentioned some talent there. Do you think that with the right mindset, with the right coaching, with the right support, if you don't have raw natural talent, can you still get to a high level?
You can get to a high level. There's a good book called Talent is Overrated, because I do get a bit annoyed when people go, oh, they're so talented, they're so gifted. Like,
like it's just...
Yeah, it's
just
not
happens.
Something that's been magicked out of the ether. Yeah. You're not gifted. Actually, you may have a predisposed genetic makeup that allows you to be a really good endurance athlete or a sprinter. You may have the parents and the support structures around you that have facilitated you to go into a sport and be engaged in that particular sport. And that will get you to a certain point. But then if you look at something like professional football, if you've got 200 plus kids at an academy, there's still only going to be maybe 1% or 2% that actually make it to that first team and actually compete at the very highest level. So there's a huge amount of dropout. The ones that will be successful will be the ones that are committed. If you haven't got, like, no matter how much I want to be a record holder at 100 meter sprint, even when I was younger, I probably not got the genetics to do that, and I didn't commit myself to that training. So I think the idea of this sort of 10,000 hour rule, where if you do something long enough for 10,000 hours of practice, you're going to be amazing, and this idea of deliberate practice, I think it holds out to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But if you lose an example of maybe me learning to play the piano, I still have to have a massive... I can't just go through and blink about on the piano and with that. I've got to have deliberate practice. I've got to be motivated. So I've still got to be really driven to want to do it. So, no, I don't think... You've got to have something.
Yeah.
But that's backed up by a lot of other things, like your commitment and the hard work.
For sure. And I think it's interesting. A lot of our listeners are business owners, leaders. And, you know, we talk about the difference between someone who maybe is underperforming, looking at whether it's a motivational issue or whether it's a skills issue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can be a skills issue, but if they're not motivated, they're not going to develop the skills. If they're motivated, often that's a big proportion of the challenge, because they're motivated to then learn and do better and do the deliberate practice, as it were.
So we see, I do a lot of work with graduates, and you see the universities churning out graduates year after year, and the profession is swamped by graduates. There's still only 1% or 2% that will actually make it to the highest level. And it's not because they've lacked skills. They've got the book smarts. They've done the 3 years. They've passed the degrees. It's the motivation. So whenever we're interviewing for new people to come into the organisations that I've worked in, the core values, the motivations are what really sets people apart, because everyone's got a very similar essential and desirable criteria. I want to know what's going to make you get out of bed in a wet, dark, cold February morning, come into the training camp or training environment and work hard when you're on a losing streak and it's not going well and everyone knows it's not going well. That's what really sets the people apart.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
If you're curious to know more about your leadership behaviours, click the link in our show notes to get 20% off a leadership DNA profile.
Tell us a little bit about the difference between coaching an individual versus the challenges of coaching a team.
Okay, well, there's kind of two sides to that. Like, individual sports, individual athletes, and team sport athletes are different animals, definitely. So I used to compete individually, and the reason I liked an individual sport rather than a team is I want to be in control of my destiny. If I lose, it's because I've not prepped enough. Even when I was at university and school, I hated group projects. Really struggled when, oh, you're paired with so-and-so and you're going to do this project and submit. And I'm thinking, well, you're not going to do your bit, so I'm going to have to do my bit extra. So I really struggle with that. And I think the individual athletes that I've worked with are very driven, very focused, selfish, but you have to be selfish to achieve. And team athletes will also share and display many of those similar properties. But I think there are times that you can have a bad day and the team will carry you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they are different. In terms of how I coach and how I work with individuals and teams, again, when you're working with a collective, that can be really challenging because I've got a squad of 26 that I might be working with in a session and I've got different motivations for each of those people. They're in different stages of their careers, their physical development. So how can you put on a session that engages with everybody? And that can be challenging. So how do I change my voice, the way that I work with them, the cues, the language that I use? How do I use other colleagues that may be younger than myself that can resonate the messages better to get the best out of the group? And then with individuals, it becomes a very personal relationship very quickly,
yeah.
I think.
And that's so similar to, if you think about it, sometimes if you're a manager or a leader in a business, you're often, you may be doing work one-on-one with someone, and then you've also then managing a team, or yeah. In some cases it's the full company,
mm-hmm.
and having to communicate and motivate and manage a group and then being able to translate that to an individual too, from a performance management standpoint, there's some of those challenges are exactly the same in a business context as they are in a sporting context. And, you know, there's been a big trend shift to people becoming better at coaching within a business, you know, being able to use coaching language, being able to use coaching methods and questioning techniques to be able to help people come up with their own solutions and feel empowered and elevated to take action. And I think, you know, years ago, that wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
And it's become more powerful and more utilized, I think, in business now. I think some of what you've just said there will resonate across a business context too.
100%. And I think the interesting piece there is, like, it's that, what you were describing. You know, you've got to figure out what motivates each individual. It's not about you. It's not about your style. It's not about what you think might work, but it's actually taking the time to figure out, what do they need? Who do they need? You know, it might not be you.
Yeah.
And I think that's tricky for leaders, but it's tricky for all of us, right? You've got to remove the ego and sometimes think, you know what? The best person for that person today is not me.
Yeah.
It might be this person, and know when to roll in those additional resources. It's almost like having that full toolkit at your disposal in order to get the best out of them.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I've learned is every coach athlete relationship has a lifespan. It almost has like a natural beginning, middle and end. And it's recognising the point when, and I see this even with players that I work with at the moment, where I've been with them for 2 or 3 years coaching. And it's like, do you know what? The message is not really starting to come through now. You need a different voice. It's not that we don't like each other. That might be the case. But it's that you just need a different stimulus to come in. So someone's going to come in and now they're going to really flick your switch and you're really going to enjoy working with them for the next period. And I'm just going to move across to someone else. So I think it's recognising that, recognising where your skill set lies best.
What cues have you used that help you recognise that?
I think I got better at it when I worked with action sports. So going into action sports, so downhill mountain biking, was very different to any other sort of Olympic or professional sport that I'd worked with. That's what I thought anyway. The perception is that they're feral and they're kind of loose characters that you have to be to point a bike down a mountain and avoid trees and not
die.
Yeah, they're kind of unique characters and just very different to how I would coach, which was very structured. And it's listening to what they were saying and what was acceptable in their world and almost living in their world. So there's photos of me riding a BMX around the inside of a gym, which in my current environment where I work, that would totally not be acceptable. But for them, it was unacceptable if I didn't do it and try and put a hot lap in. So it's kind of dressing the right way, using the right language, taking their cues, trying to understand their world. And not that I kind of change, it's more like a chameleon. I'm still me, still fundamentally it's me, but I just adjust to how I'm going to work with them and take their cues in language, behaviour, try and listen to what they're saying. And one of the big things I learned from the action sports was this idea of we're all looking at the same map. It's just from a different vantage point. So we're looking at the same thing. It's just you're sitting opposite the desk looking at it from a slightly different viewpoint. So to understand your motivations and to get you working, I need to come around and look at the map from your viewpoint and then try and make the changes based on that.
I think that's fascinating, isn't it? And it's what we talk about, especially when leaders go into new businesses or they get new teams, that it's about having that self-awareness that you can't just lead how you've always led.
Yeah.
And that's not going to work necessarily with that new team. You've got to take the time to figure out what do they need from you.
Yeah.
What have they had before? What worked? What didn't work? Take that bedding in time to then almost establish what is the new norm that it needs to be.
And that's sometimes a challenge, because if you get a new role or you have a new position, often your automatic default is to go in almost proven mode. Like, you can make a difference, you're going to make a change, this is going to be the best coach you've ever had or the best leader you've ever had. And sometimes you can be almost impatient to make your mark.
Yep.
But taking that pause, taking the learning, and just a moment to assess a situation or assess people is so important. But honestly, it's one of the biggest mistakes we see when people get new roles or commit a new position in a business. Or if there's been like an acquisition where two businesses have merged, they want to make their mark too quickly. And that can actually cause so much disruption that you end up like losing, you lose the battle or you lose the starting point, the foundational stuff.
I think people often want to be that superhero. They want to fly in and like fix everything straight away. I think one of the, if I reflect and I think if people were to say, one of the things I try and do when I onboard to a new organization or a new team is just sit back and take my time. You know, there are different approaches, I appreciate that, but this idea of just like, what do we need to do? At the moment, there's probably a lot of good stuff already taking place. Let's sit and observe and see what's good and then see where maybe I can add a few little things. And just, it's a cliche, but it's more about evolution than revolution. It's like, just let's try and evolve this gradually over time. And often people are quite surprised because they think you're just going to walk in and go, right, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. It's like you're probably doing a lot of really good things already, just needs a few little tweaks.
Yeah, you've got into the people that you're working with, they're working at a super high level. They haven't got there by doing nothing, have they? They've got there through good practice, but there might just be some extra things that you can add.
Yeah, but when I first started, I was so arrogant, I thought I had all the answers. So it's like, no, don't worry about that. You've been training for like 20 years and you've been pretty successful.
You've been an Olympic athlete before.
I've been to university, you know, hey, I've done 4 years. I know what's going on here. You find out very quickly that's not the approach that's going to be effective.
Yeah. And you know what? That is, I mean, we're looking at your behavioural map here and you do have a dominant strength in what we call internal, but it's where your source of reference is yourself. More often than enough, you'll fathom out how you feel or make a decision internally before you then go and check it maybe with someone else or other people. And that often means that there's almost that piece around like you think you know best or you want to know best. You want to get it right.
Yeah.
So has that ever been a challenge for you over the years in your journey as a coach? Has that ever come a cropper?
Yeah, I think people's perception, particularly again in very fast moving sports where there is that instant change culture of we've got to do this now. You know, I'm very much like, just because we can doesn't mean we should. Let's just have a pause and have a breath. And I think sometimes people might perceive that as just not being able to make a decision and not moving fast enough. And I know certainly when I'm in meetings, I always have the really good ideas about 10 minutes after I've been in the meeting. And there are people that are really quick to voice their opinions all the time, but I'll only speak if I think I've got something worth saying. So I think, yeah, in certain environments, people just think, oh, Nick's just being really quiet and sat in the corner, not contributing. I'm trying to observe and listen. And once I've come up with a useful insight, I'll give it later.
You've just described this one behaviour that have two opposite ends of the spectrum that cause the most challenge in businesses from a meeting perspective.
Yeah.
And it's that some people are driven by action. So you ask a question and they're already wanting to answer before you've even finished answering the question.
Laura.
Case in point. And then you've got other people where they are absolutely listening and they're in the room, but they're formulating the answer before they answer.
Yeah.
And I think the big mistake that we see, and often the almost instant change that we make in a business straight away, is how people run meetings. Because the way you've described your pattern and where you sit, you know, I know to get most performance out of you. If I want something in the room, give you two or three bullet points before a meeting. We're going to talk about these few things. Take an hour, come with your thoughts. You'll then be able to just put it all on the table. Or go away and have half an hour afterwards, because your speed of reflection, I mean, the map doesn't tell us this, but we can tell this, is fairly quick.
Yeah.
So some people's reflection times are a lot longer. But when people are more reflective, they will work better when they've got time to consider. That's the beautiful thing about that behaviour. On the flip side, the people who are high initiation work best when they can drive an action.
Yeah.
But it's finding that balance and getting the best out of people. And often that meeting type environment, you get good things out of one type of person, and that's it.
Yeah.
So this is, I'm interested to know a little bit about how you balance sort of your professional life with your personal life. You've mentioned family. And I know that, you know, this is quite a demanding job. It requires a lot from you. Yeah. How have you managed to strike that balance between the two?
You should speak to my wife. She'd probably be able to. It's difficult. I think people trying to pursue balance are probably on a hiding to nothing. If you're being honest, I think you end up just doing none of it particularly well. So I think of balance kind of in a more of a long term. Again, that probably comes back to my coaching, planning 3-4 year cycles. But it's understanding that during your career or during your life, you're going to have periods of imbalance, whether that's out partying all the time and being with your friends and not really hitting your career, or flipping it the other way and going, okay, now I'm really going to work on my studies and my career. So I think all the way through your life, it kind of ebbs and flows. But over the long term, you will get that balance. You know, you're not just kind of a dropout and doing nothing for the whole of your life, and you're not just working yourself to the bone. So I think there have been times when it's been full on. You know, if you're getting ready for an Olympic Games, it's not a dip your toe in the water. You have to commit and you're in. But it's being with my wife and my family who understand, you know, we met at university. She knows that I was a competitive athlete at the time. She kind of knew what she was signing up for, and it works for us. It wouldn't work for everybody. But equally, then when it's with the family, I think I am pretty good and getting better at that's the time that I'm with you. And by the way, just because the phone's ringing, it's not getting answered. That can wait.
Stop being present.
Yeah, it is.
Rather than a balance in time. And we're not believers of balance in the true sense of the word. Like, you know, you allocate 50% of your time here and 50% of your time here, or 25, 25, 25, 25. It's more about that being present.
Yeah.
It's quite tricky, but it sounds like that's something you've worked on.
It is hard. And I think what I've also been very lucky to be able to do is with the teams and athletes I've worked with, is almost trying to create a connection with the athletes and the family so that both know what's going on. So one of the things that I can look at is working with the downhill mountain bikers. And one thing that I learned there was to try and make this connection between my family so that they understand who I'm going to see and the mountain bikers know who I'm coming to see. So there's that sort of, when I started working with them, I was told that they would always be late for appointments and sessions. And bearing in mind, I was leaving Newcastle at sort of 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to get across for a 10 o'clock training session. So I'm like, well, if I can get there for 10 o'clock, they need to. And I spoke to a colleague from Canada, and he works in action sports. And he's like, just start having conversations with them about your family and what you're doing. Like, not laying a guilt trip on them, but just letting them know, hey, listen, I got up at 4 o'clock and I didn't get to give my kids a kiss before they go to school. And, you know, so that's fine. And I'm not putting that on you, but just let you know that's a sacrifice I'm making to get here for 10. You've only got to come half an hour, so make sure you're here for 10. I think the athlete was late for one training session and was on the phone to me apologising as she was coming across to that training session. Yeah. And then what we've also been very lucky to do is bring them to meet the players and the athletes, or go and watch the team compete. And that gives you a connection. So it's not, I'm going to go and work with the mountain bikers, I'm going to work with Rach and G. And my kids know who Rach and G are, and they meet the players that I'm working with currently. And so it's like, today's really important because I've got to go and work with so-and-so who's injured at the moment, and, you know, we've got to get them back for the next game. And
they've got that emotional, personal connection, haven't they?
And equally, the players then understand that I'm like, listen, you were late for the session, so by the way, I'm going now because I'm going to see my son play football.
Yeah.
And if you've got that connection, it is easier.
It's so interesting. We use a bit of a model when people have difficult conversations. And we talk about this concept of, you can have a difficult conversation and just share the issue. You know, you could say, for example, you were late today, why were you late? And when you add in a relationship element to it, it changes the trajectory of the difficult conversation. So instead of, you were late today, why were you late? You were late today, I want to understand what's going on there. Because actually now I need to leave because I've made a commitment to my son that I'm going to be there to watch him. That human connection that level of conversation has is a whole different connection to just that when you leave that relationship piece out, and people just relate and have that empathy. And kind of to testament to your point, they don't mess you around because I actually now understand the reason. He's not just being a dick asking me and challenging me. There's actually, there's a human piece at the end of this.
It's a bit of a conundrum of that, though, isn't there? Because often, certainly in a business context, people feel like they don't want to bring their personal life into their professional life. And there's this, I think we're getting more open, but there definitely has been over the years, like a bit of stigma around doing that. Like, keep your personal life personal, keep your professional life professional. But actually, I mean, I'm a massive believer that you're one person.
Yeah.
Right. And you might have different roles that you have in your life, but you're one person. And actually making those connections is about you being authentic, but also just about you showcasing like what's important in your life. It allows you to set much more realistic expectations at the front end if you can explain that.
Yeah.
Like, we had a meeting last week and Laura had a commitment to pick a little one up. So I just said at the very start, we do have to finish on time with this one because we've got a non-compromise for the end time, because I know we could chat all day. But I was just super open about that at the front end. And we were unapologetic about like that stuff, because ultimately we're running a business, but we also do have other commitments and family lives that are super important to us. And we never want our family to feel like that's not important, and vice versa for clients and people we work with and our team members to not feel important. But that being present, I think it comes back to that. And that connection piece is such a lovely takeaway.
And I think that kind of takes us on. It's obviously doing what you do. It's important to have that deep connection with the athletes that you're working with.
Yeah.
What other techniques do you use to build that?
I just think it's like a daily trust project. Every day with an athlete or a staff member that you're working with is a daily trust project. It's about putting the pennies in the jar so that when things may go wrong or someone is late, they make a withdrawal, but they've not gone into debt in that. So it's just, if I say I'm going to be somewhere, I'll be there at that time. If I say I'm going to do something, we'll do it. An example, and I know you've had a previous guest on, Craig Heap, who was the Olympic gymnast.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Yeah.
So unfortunately, Craig broke his hand about 6 weeks out from the Olympics. And we had a conversation. We're like, we'll do anything we can to get you there. We're behind you. We're going to do everything we can. And then one day he told me he was, because he doesn't always come up with the best ideas, that he was going to go and see Oasis in concert down in London and that he was going to drive. And he's like, it's okay, my girlfriend will change gears for us. And I was like, that's the most stupid, of all the stupid things you've said, that's one of the most stupid things you've done. And he said, so then he sent me a text later that night. He said, you'd said at the start of the rehab, you would do anything for us to get us to, he said, would you drive us down to London to come? So I've got tickets, you can come to see Oasis. And Kate's reaction, my wife's reaction, was a bit like yours just there. She's like, you are joking. I said, but I did kind of say that. And it was...
You need to create better contracts up front here.
I am very bad at it. I have made bad contracts about before with my daughter learning to swim on a holiday in America that bit me as well. But we did. I drove him to London. I had tickets for Oasis. We went. And it was, I mean, it's quite an extreme version of trust. But it was like, no, I said I was prepared to do anything to get you to Sydney. And that's one of it, to make sure that you're safe and that you're not going to re-injure yourself doing something stupid. So they don't all have to be like that. It's as simple as, I'm going to write you a training program. The training program gets written. I'm going to be in this session at 9 o'clock. You're there at 9 o'clock.
That follow through is so important to build trust. Yeah. And we talk about that a lot when people are doing sort of appraisals or holding people accountable. And if you commit to something, it's then making sure that you follow through on that. And if someone else commits to something, that you follow through with them on them fulfilling that. And it's really important, because if you don't, subliminally the trust goes and you don't know it's, you don't even know it's going. That's the danger point.
Yeah, and trust isn't like always a big thing, gesture that you have to do. And I talked to my kids about this, because again, I read this before about like friendship groups and, oh, well, so-and-so's done this and they're not my friend anymore. It's like kids, everybody puts a penny of trust in the jar each day, and you build that up and up and up. And so one of your friends might do something one day that breaks your trust, but they've only taken one penny out. They've still got 50 in there. So actually, they're still one of your good friends. But if they've only got one penny in there and then they take five out, well, maybe that's not the person that you thought they were. So that trust has gone. So yeah, just think about it like that, really, with the athletes, of just every day trying to do something that says, yeah, I've got your back, I'm shoulder to shoulder with you.
I think so, that's a really lovely message.
Yeah, it is a lovely message. It's a lovely visual, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, again, it's not one of mine. I've read that and seen that somewhere.
You can take credit for that.
No.
You know, all the best things are things that are borrowed from other brilliant, inspirational people. So tell us a little bit about future stuff. What's next for you?
I honestly don't know. Like, I've never had kind of like a grand plan of oh, in 5 years' time, I want to be doing X or Y. I just know that I really love working with athletes, with coaches, with trying to help people realize their potential. And hopefully that's still within the sporting world and environment. And I would still like to have some sort of front-facing delivery role. But as you get older, you lose a little bit of that connection with sort of 19, 20-year-old athletes. So I accept that there'd probably be a little bit more of a strategic role, maybe wearing some sensible clothes and adult clothes rather than shorts and T-shirts. I might have to wear a collar every now and then. But where I go and where I work, I don't really know. Stuff kind of just seems to happen, which I know it doesn't really. But throughout my career, things just have kind of fallen into place.
That sounds like opportunities are coming your way because you're attracting them. And I think, you know, people often talk about luck or they talk about like, oh, I was in the right place at the right time. But actually, sometimes it's organic and sometimes you follow a pathway and things happen. But there's a strategy behind that. It's just maybe a little bit more subliminal than obvious.
So one of my favorite things is like, it's not lucky. It's the crossroads between opportunity and preparation. Mm-hmm. So like if you're prepped, if you've done the groundwork, then when the opportunity presents itself, like randomly, you're ready to go and you're good to go. So that's one thing that I've always kind of held.
I think that's amazing. We talk about black swan moments and that things can happen at any point. We did it from a business context. You know, we did a bit of an exercise where we said, you know, if an opportunity came that enabled us to 10x our business, would we be ready? And then you can almost do that prep of like, okay, well, what would need a change? What wouldn't be ready? And I think that's a great example of that preparation piece of like, now if an opportunity comes, you're ready.
Yeah.
I've got a last little question for you that we get asked about motivating people towards goals a lot. And I'm interested in your thoughts on, it's obviously very different to motivate an Olympic athlete and work them towards, say, a four-year goal versus motivating a Premiership football player that's going to play numerous games fairly quickly in succession. Yeah. What different techniques do you use for those different long and short-term goals?
I think with both types of athlete, when it comes to goal setting, so everyone does SMART, like everyone knows that to death, but I think the bits that people don't look at are outcome, performance and process. And they're the key. So having an outcome goal is easy. Like, I want to win an Olympic medal or I want to play 30 games in the Premier League. So that's kind of easy. But those aren't always under your control. So what you need to drill down into the next level is the performance goal. So what are the performance levels that you need to achieve to be able to then win a medal? So how fast have you got to sprint? How strong have you got to be? What's your endurance got to be? And then the bit that no one ever talks about, which is why most people that embark on a fitness regime or a diet fail, is the boring stuff, which goes back to what we talked about in terms of motivation versus commitment, is this idea of the process goals. Okay, so you want to improve your strength levels by X, and we've got 12 weeks to do that. In order to do that, I need you to do this program 5 times a week. And it's at that point when you're having these conversations about what it actually takes, the boring basics, that you'll know whether someone's going to hit that goal or not. Because everyone can have a dream and do this kind of positive fantasizing of what they want to do, but actually that's not what gets the job done.
Yeah,
it's the nitty gritty. So yeah, that's, I probably look at the process across both athletes in terms of a week to week, day to day basis.
So that methodology is the same. It's just that the process and the things that go into that might be slightly different depending on that longevity.
Yeah, it's just that you're probably with someone that's performing week in, week out, you're probably just shortening the time frames down and having chunking the program up in a slightly smaller way. Whereas with the longer term goals, you've got bigger time periods that you're working towards and maybe slightly bigger, scarier goals that you can hit at each stage.
Well, I think that is a lovely practical takeaway that people can work through. So thank you so much for joining us. We have loved having you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
So let's wrap up with some key takeaways from Nick's episode. The first one being how you think about your goals and the potential of adding a review of the outcome, the performance and the process to how those goals are met. So thinking about the outcome that you want to achieve, the performance improvement needed, and then really thinking through that process and that plan so that you can consistently work towards those goals. Nick also talked about a really lovely piece around the Daily Trust Project and actually using that as a leader or as a coach to build that connection with your team. And he used that example of using that personal connection with his family. You could use it with your family, you could use it with other team members to build expectations. So rather than those hard-lined expectations of, I need you here at this time, I need you here at this time because this is what it's impacting me personally, and really building that relationship and that trust that way. He also talked about that concept of reviewing what your team or the room needs on any given day or time, and acknowledging that that might not always be you. Sometimes, depending on the communication that you're rolling out, the change that you're enacting, the coaching that you need to deliver, there may well be different people in your business or even as external advisors that might be better to deliver that to your team than you.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.